in which corporate America takes some lessons from history. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday, today the 14th of August. Good as always to have you along, everybody. History coming up later in the program. But first, you know what we haven't done in a while? What with the trade and the tariff and the turkey news that has been so front and center of late? We haven't started with a good old-fashioned corporate story. So we're going to do that today, and it comes to us courtesy of ticker symbol HD Home Depot, which reported quite healthy second quarter profits this morning, up 31% over the same period a year ago. Marketplace's Andy Euler gets us going with the macroeconomic indicator that can be home improvement retailing.
Not everybody was expecting this kind of growth, but Home Depot has worked hard to improve its online tools to make it easier to buy stuff online or find it while you're at the store. And the retail chain has spent a lot to do that over the past year.
And sometimes that makes you incur a lot of debt if you're not doing the right strategy and you don't have the top line results to support it.
That's Barbara Kahn. She's a professor of marketing at the Wharton School of Business.
In this case, it seemed to all come together.
With home supply tight and prices beyond many people's reach, folks are staying put and doing up their current homes, which can be a good thing for home improvement retailers. Hannah Hayes at Kantar Consulting says Home Depot is also in the middle of a massive five-year supply chain overhaul to improve its offerings to contractors and construction companies.
They're really thinking strategically about how they can best optimize that for themselves, but also handle big, bulky freight.
Of course, Home Depot, like all retailers nowadays, has to handle the elephant in the room, Amazon. So it's installed lockers in some locations where customers can pick up the stuff ordered online without having to wait at a register. As for whether other home improvement companies can expect similar strong results, we'll see soon enough. Home Depot's biggest competitor, Lowe's, releases its second quarter report next week. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Quick promo here, if I might. We had Home Depot CEO Craig Menear on the program not too long ago. You can hear that interview on our Corner Office podcast. Today's a big day for aspiring financial professionals. The results of levels 1 and 2 of the Chartered Financial Analyst exam came out this morning. Two of the three tests you have to pass to be a Chartered Financial Analyst. Less than half the takers, it turns out, made the grade. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore has that one.
It is hard to tell whether the CFA exams are a source of pride or a source of trauma for the hundreds of thousands of people who take them each year.
I remember it very well, both fondly and not so fondly.
It is burned in my memory. And once you're past it, you breathe a great sigh of relief and think, thank goodness I don't have to do that again.
Charles Regaus, Managing Director at Exponential ETF, Susan Schmidt, Senior Portfolio Manager at Westwood Holdings Group. There are three exams, 6 hours each, usually spaced a year apart. They cover anything you need to know to be able to analyze companies, manage portfolios, and do both ethically. Casey Flanagan is an analyst at Westwood Holdings Group. He took the third and final exam this year.
January is when you first get your books in the mail, start studying, and then for the next 6 months, you're sitting alone on the weekend studying in the library or wherever it might be.
Flanagan won't find out how he did for another couple weeks. Most people have to take the exams multiple times before they pass. Stephen Horan is with the CFA Institute, which administers the exams.
It's not hard for the sake of being hard, but what we're trying to do is build an investment management profession.
Many employers pressure their people to pass. Susan Schmidt with Westwood Holdings Group says, aside from the subject matter, the exams teach you something about how hard the job can be.
As a professional investor, you sometimes get kicked in the teeth, much like you feel when you fail the CFA exam, and yet you have to come back and do it again the next day.
Passing the CFA exams, she says, is a testament to perseverance. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
So we were talking yesterday about fax machines, and yes, a lot of offices still have them. We were talking about how those machines can be hacked and how that might make your office network vulnerable, right? Today, cash machines, aka ATMs. The website Krebs on Security reports that the FBI has warned banks around the country about a global fraud scheme called an ATM cash out. From the Marketplace desk of whatever that is, it can't possibly be good. Marketplace's Mariel Segarra reports.
What I'm about to describe is going to sound like a heist movie. Here goes. An ATM cash out begins when a group of cyber criminals breaks into a bank's computer system, maybe through a phishing email. Next, the criminals steal a bunch of account numbers and make fake debit cards. Then, says Chester Wisniewski at the security firm Sophos, they recruit help.
They would go into underground markets and forums and start going, right, we're going to do one of these unlimited cash out attacks where we're going to steal millions of dollars, but we need people on the ground.
The criminals lift the controls at a bank's ATMs, overwriting PIN numbers and nixing withdrawal limits. And then they fan out across the country and bleed the ATMs dry.
If they hit all those ATMs at the same time, they can get a huge amount of money out.
ATM cash outs aren't just theoretical. A bank in Virginia lost a couple million dollars in a recent attack. Fred Kate at Indiana University says ATMs have always been vulnerable.
Lots of times people, for example, get their cards skimmed, where somebody makes a copy of their ATM card and then they can go take money out of their account. This is a much more sophisticated attack.
And because ATM cash outs are so sophisticated, they're an especially big problem for small and mid-sized banks. Al Pasquale is head of fraud security at Javelin Strategy and Research.
Maybe their security awareness program isn't great, and their employees consequently are not as good at spotting phishing emails.
And that makes small banks an easier target for cyber criminals. I'm Marielle Segarra for Marketplace.
Wall Street on this Tuesday. Turkish contagion? What Turkish contagion? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There's a movie opening tomorrow that's getting a whole lot of buzz, in part because it's supposed to be pretty good, but also because Crazy Rich Asians, that's the name of the film based on the book of the same name, is the first studio film since 1993 to have an entirely Asian cast. It comes, as even casual observers know, as Hollywood is finally coming to grips with its lack of diversity. John M. Chu directed the picture. Thanks for coming into the studio.
Pleasure to be here.
So you read this book. Give me the elevator pitch when you wanted to get it made.
I was looking for a project that was personal to me, especially considering I'd never dealt with my own cultural identity of as being an Asian American. That's the last thing I wanted to deal with or talk about. But I felt like I was getting older and I was having a baby. And so there was stuff that I wanted to figure out for myself. So my sister emailed me about the book. My mom emailed me about the book. And so I took it on and I demanded that I'd be a part of it.
You've been in Hollywood. I mean, you're a young guy. You're like 38, 39 years old, right?
Mm-hmm.
But you've been in Hollywood for a long time.
It's been a journey. This is my eighth movie in 10 years.
In a way, you're part of the system. Not in a way. You are part of the system.
I am part of the system. I think that was the wake-up call. As I was reading this stuff a couple years ago on Twitter about Oscar So White, whitewashed out, I learned. I was reading. I was listening to people, and I realized, yeah, they're right. And when I looked in the mirror, I realized, oh, I am Hollywood. I'm here. This is my whole life. So I had to do something. If I wasn't going to do anything, then I should just shut up. But at this point, I had an opportunity. So.
Well, so here comes the put up or shut up question, right? Because this is the first all-Asian film, major film, coming out of Hollywood in like 25 years,
Many years, yes.
What's your stress level and what happens if this doesn't land big?
If it doesn't land big, the fight will keep going. We'll keep making stuff. That's not what it's at stake. What's at stake, I think, is if people show up, it accelerates it. It's a message to the studios that there's good business here, to the conglomerates that own the studios, to all other mediums. It says that it's worth your time and your energy to, one, invest tens of millions of dollars to have one of these types of movies. And I think that every movie that comes out that proves the point changes the dynamics, makes the studios say less and less that there is some reason why they can't make these movies. So this is the new cinematic universe. It is perspective and new stories.
It was important, really important, for you to get this movie to the big screen versus TV. Netflix actually offered more money, right?
Yeah, and Netflix has more eyeballs like immediately all around the world. You don't have to wait for it. There's no reviews. There's no opening weekend to decide this or that.
Nobody knows what the numbers
Nobody
are.
Nobody knows.
Yeah.
It's great. So that was a difficult decision. There was no guarantee for the Warner Brothers side how many theaters, how much marketing dollars they would put in. But we knew that movies still have meaning. Movies still impact culture more than anything in the world. We would not have this fervor or this energy if we were just another one on Netflix. And I love Netflix. Don't get me wrong. Yeah. I want to work with them.
Because they're the
great.
Next deal, right?
Yeah. They're the next deal. But Warner Brothers, to say the most old school studios to green light this movie and say, hey, we will bet on this. You should too. Pours into all media and all pop culture, actually.
To, I can't believe I'm asking this of a 38, 39-year-old guy, but to your legacy now after this film, you're working on an adaptation of Lin-Manuel Miranda's In the Heights,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, a musical all about immigrants as
right,
well.
Right, mm-hmm. Dominicans, I think, mm-hmm. In Washington Heights in New York. And also the Thai cave rescue.
Yeah.
So the question is this now your mission going forward to make sure that American cinema is more representative?
I think, what can I do that no one else can do? I'm in this position, in a very lucky position. I was discovered. I didn't have to do commercials or music videos to get to this point. I've been very blessed. Never had to raise money for an independent movie. So what am I doing with that? What am I actually pushing the boundaries of that in this position? And that's, I think, my new chapter two, is I'm looking for projects that other people actually can't do and I can push forward.
Film is Crazy Rich Asians. John M. Chu is the man here. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Don't look now, but the Greek debt crisis is officially going to be over on Monday. Greece, as you might remember, borrowed more than $260 billion at rock-bottom interest rates from the bailout fund set up by the European Union and the International Monetary Fund. The thinking now is that Athens can finally finance itself in the capital markets. The Greek government says, and this is a quote, it's a turning point. The EU calls it a marvelous comeback. Ordinary Greek people and what they say? Marketplace's Stephen Beard, who has covered the crisis for us low these many years, went back to Athens to find out.
The Athens Chamber of Commerce knows full well the cost of the crisis. More than a quarter of a million Greek businesses went bust. Unemployment hit 28%. The Greek economy shrank by almost as much as the US during the Great Depression. But today, the head of the chamber, Konstantin Mikolaos, is upbeat about bailout exit day.
This is a historical moment. This is a new page, a new chapter. I am quite optimistic, and I'm sure that we will be successful.
The crisis is over, says the government. The Greek people can smile again. But on the streets of Athens, few seem to believe that the country is ready to stand on its own two feet or that bailout exit day will be a new beginning.
It's just a day like the others.
You don't think it's going to make a big difference?
No.
I mean, it's a joke. Okay, let's be honest here. Nothing has really changed.
Yes, I don't think any average people will go there. A normal citizen will celebrate.
It will be nothing to celebrate.
Of course not. Of course, it's a joke. It's a joke. No, it's a joke.
That was Christos Mavrou, Nikos Voglis and Spiros Kontagianis. In spite of their scepticism, the Greek economy has improved. It's out of recession and growing at 2% a year. The government's finances are in much better shape. But the benefits are barely filtering through to the general public. Spiros Kontagianis runs a flower shop underneath the Parliament building. He's complaining even though his shop is still open.
I'm still open because I have no employees, which means I do everything.
But you are still making a profit.
Marginal, I would say it now. And if the consumption goes down, I don't think I will survive.
10 years of crisis and 8 years of austerity have battered the country's confidence. Cicadas singing, the sound of summer, usually the time for Greeks to chill out and party. But in this small square, sheltering from the heat under a tree full of cicadas, copywriter Fortis Mantelos told me there's a gloomier mood here today.
You barely see people that are really, really happy. And, you know, we have such a beautiful country with sun, but we're not enjoying ourselves that much because everybody back in their mind have this... this miserable thing that always keeps us behind and not letting us feel happier about our lives.
When I first met Fortis 6 years ago, he was scraping by on meagre, erratic wages from part-time work. He was still living with his parents. Things are better today. He has a steady job in advertising and can now afford a place of his own. But wages here have fallen by a third over the last decade. Fortis can't afford much else beyond the rent.
I'm still trying to scrape my way. For example, I don't have a car. I can't afford a car now. I have moved on since the crisis, but I'm not a happier person.
Nor is Oleana Spiridopoulos. Her business thrived in the early years of the crisis, but is now faltering. She and her husband, Yanis, sell and rent designer handbags.
What I will show you right now is a handbag which we rent. It's classic Chanel, medium flap, white, all white.
business was brisk in the early part of the downturn as Greeks strove to keep up appearances. But, says Yanis, even renting a bag for $80 a night, let alone buying one for many hundreds, has lost its allure.
People are not as happy as they used to be. And if your everyday existence is not really as good as it used to be, you don't want to have to spend that kind of money. You just don't want to do it.
And he doesn't believe that bailout exit day, when Greece is supposed to support itself again, will restore consumer confidence. Rather the opposite.
Greeks are weird, you know. They're just as soon as you let them do their own thing, they just go and screw everything up. What can I tell you? We're not very good at looking after our own affairs.
That's not what Greece's Eurozone partners want to hear. They hope that bailout exit will herald a fresh start for the currency bloc's most notorious backslider. In Athens, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Coming up, an overlooked part of this country's economic history.
In some cases, innovation was a byproduct of bondage.
But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 112 today, 0.4%, closed at 25,299. NASDAQ up 51 points, 0.6%, 78.70. The S&P 500 gained 18 points, also 0.6%, 28.39. Chipmaker NVIDIA improved 2% after rolling out its latest chip technology. Qualcomm clicked up 0.9% today. Home Depot hammered down 0.5%. The stock weakened despite those second quarter results we told you about. Why? All together now, because capitalism. Bond prices fell. Yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.90%. You're listening to Marketplace. Just as you count on Marketplace for fact-based, unbiased news and information, we are counting on listeners like you to invest in what we do. And right now, your donation in any amount could unlock a $25,000 challenge from Candida if we meet our goal of 6,000 Marketplace investors this fiscal year. So please support public service journalism today at Marketplace.org, and thanks. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. We're going to do a little history now. Some really uncomfortable history, actually, about slavery, the economic realities of slavery, and how the conventional wisdom about one of the many ways that slave economy affects this country to this day is wrong. There's a book out this week. It hasn't gotten a whole lot of attention so far, but it talks about a sometimes overlooked part of our economic history. The book is called Accounting for Slavery by historian Caitlin Rosenthal. And in it, she argues that some of the management practices used in corporate America today, long thought to have been popularized in the factories of the industrialized North, were actually far more widespread on the plantations of the American South. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams spent some time with Caitlin Rosenthal at Thomas Jefferson's plantation, Monticello.
Even on the rainiest of summer days, Monticello is still busy, with hundreds of tourists wandering the expansive grounds and gardens of Jefferson's plantation in central Virginia. Caitlin Rosenthal, under an umbrella, views the rain as kind of perfect.
Account books always begin with the weather. Often it's raining and people are still in the fields. I mean, it's really wet, but it's not torrential, so people are probably still working.
The people she's talking about were slaves, or more accurately, people enslaved by plantation owners like Thomas Jefferson. Rosenthal is an assistant professor of history at UC Berkeley. She spent the last decade digging through plantation account books from the 1700s and 1800s, studying how slavery worked. Even after spending so much time immersed in those details, she still finds it jarring every time she visits a plantation. We start, along with some tourists, on Monticello's Mulberry Row, the former site of the plantation's many workshops, where the weaving, woodworking, and smithing were done.
What is that?
Some bellows.
Rosenthal says slaves would have operated those bellows in the reconstructed blacksmith shop. They did most of the skilled work here.
So thinking about enslaved people as capital meant that if you trained them as blacksmiths or something like that, you might increase their value to you.
And slaveholders tracked their human assets with a level of detail similar to what you see in modern accounting techniques, adjusting values upward as children grew into working adults and learned new skills.
But then also on the backside, keeping track of their depreciation in value as they grow older, if they're injured. And these relatively sophisticated valuations even extend to people sometimes receiving a negative value.
Negative because the cost to slaveholders of keeping the person alive was greater than the profit their labor could produce. We follow a gravel walkway from Mulberry Row and up the hill towards Jefferson's home. As we walk, the part of the estate where the workshops and slave quarters once stood slowly disappears below the sightline. From the patio just off Jefferson's library, the view is sweeping and beautiful, mountains and valleys. The disconnect between the slaveholder and his property is intentional.
So this is just like my experience being in the space, is just to remind yourself of the extent of the power imbalances that are everywhere.
Jefferson's library, think of it as the corner office of the plantation, contains hundreds of leather-bound volumes, many of them accounting ledgers and farm records. Nia Bates is public historian of slavery and African-American life at Monticello. She says Jefferson kept meticulous accounts.
He would write nuclear family groups together, so that's helped us with the genealogical research. He would write out their rations, so we're able to know what they're getting.
And this is how historians have traditionally used these records, to examine the lives of the slaves. At Monticello, they're being used to inform a new series of exhibits that more accurately depicts the lives of those enslaved there. But Bates says these records also tell the story of the business of the plantation.
Monticello was an economic enterprise, and that's how Jefferson was making the majority of his money. So the labor of enslaved people here is really the economic basis of Jefferson's wealth.
Caitlin Rosenthal says the cotton plantations further south and the sugar plantations in the Caribbean were even more advanced than Monticello. Their records reminded Rosenthal of spreadsheets she used in her previous job as a management consultant, advising companies on how to improve productivity.
In some cases, innovation was a byproduct of bondage. Planters were making really sophisticated business decisions about, of course, this most horrifying and totally commodified human body.
Decisions based on what we think of today as data, handwritten in neat columns. Food allowed, rest allowed, working conditions, pounds of cotton picked or sugar harvested, human value tracked right alongside the value of livestock.
There was this idea that if you just found the right data and brought the right tools that you could increase output. And this is like the core idea that I think you find management consultants taking to businesses today.
But unlike businesses of today, slaveholders had complete control over workers' lives and limitless power to experiment with different methods to increase productivity.
One of the most harrowing would have been punishing slaves who fell short.
In ways that are familiar, yet remain deeply disturbing. Like whipping.
Like for every pound they fell short of a target, they might receive one lash. So each incremental pound is incentivized by that little bit of violence.
Some slaveholders used less violent incentives, even rewards, more food, extra clothing.
There are even cases where planters apparently ran contests where they would offer a prize because planters were trying to use every bit of that labor potential from child to adult.
Rosenthal says the account books also reveal stories of resistance, slaves working more slowly or hiding their true abilities. But she says those stories are nearly buried under the weight of the human toll documented in the thousands of yellowed plantation records that still exist. One set of records in particular has stayed with her. They detailed the value of children. Two of those children had the same names as Rosenthal's young son and daughter, Edward and Eliza.
To look at that list and see the values attached to their names and the fact that I get to have no prices attached to my kids is like an incredible and privilege that none of these people had.
Children, according to one accounting formula, should be valued at $25 at birth, $75 at their first birthday, add $25 a year until they turn 10, and from there, the market price. At Monticello, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
You can see some examples of those old plantation records and read more about Kimberly's conversation with Caitlin Rosenthal at our website. It's marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today, which one can put nowhere other than in the what could possibly go wrong file. ESPN reports that in the city of Cleveland, Ohio, whose NFL team, the Browns, has gone 17 straight regular season games without a win. Bud Light, the official beer of the NFL, by the way, and beer there is in air quotes. Anyway, it's begun installing victory fridges in some bars around town. And when the Browns do finally win their first regular season game after that long dry spell, those fridges will be unlocked and everybody will get free beer. I mean, come on, man. Ooh, look at the time. We got to go. The markets, well, we did those already. Our digital team includes Sarah Menendez, Tony Wagner, and Joanne Griffith. Ben Heathcote is the digital visual producer. Sarah Muti is the executive director of digital. Star Nieves is our executive director of On Demand. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.